Friday, we have one case set for 1:30 for oral argument today. The panel, let me introduce the panel, gentlemen, to my right. Can you hear me? All righty, sorry, I'm in my lower register. To my right is Justice Dana Womack. To my left is Justice Mike Wallach, D. Michael Wallach, sorry. And I am Wade Birdwell, who finds himself as the senior member of the panel, which is surprising in and of itself. But that is who is to hear the case today. And so, barring anything else, if we will have the clerk call the case, we would begin.
Court will now call Justin Michael Love versus the State of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. James Rasmussen will argue for the appellant. Mr. Bryce Perry will argue for the state.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
Perry. Thank you for hearing argument on this important case. This case has been before this court before. The offense is engaging in organized criminal activity, and it was reversed on a prior occasion for structural error, which is somewhat unusual, based upon denial of the defendant's right to retain counsel. His counsel was removed by the trial judge, and the case was reversed, and it was put back on retrial, and we have presented to the court 5 points of error or issues, and I'll start out addressing the first one, but I'm happy to entertain any questions that the court may have. I think I put in my request that I thought oral argument would be useful just because of the unusual nature of some of the issues. The first issue, the first complaint, is that the application paragraph of the court omits any reference to the intent necessary for a party liability conviction. It was the state's theory that Mr. Love shouted to the shooter to shoot Mr. Thrasher, the victim in this case, or if he didn't do that, that he anticipated that a shooting would occur at that time. It is, and we've argued a case very similar out of Houston, which went up before the Court of Criminal Appeals, where the Court of Criminal Appeals made it clear that for party liability to be established, you have to have a finding by the jury that the so-called party intended or had an intent to promote or assist the crime, or should have anticipated the offense. That was not done in this case. The state has argued in their response that there was an abstract instruction about party liability, and that was referred to in the application paragraph, and they're saying that's sufficient. It's our reply to their response that that's not sufficient because of the fact that the jury could have determined that this party liability only pertained to the marijuana distribution. And so the abstract doesn't get it done. So there's no finding by a jury as to an essential element of the offense that Mr. Love either intended to promote or assist this offense, or that he should have anticipated that a shooting would occur. And the jury has never made that finding, and the application paragraph just doesn't have it in there. So that's the argument with regard to point number one.
Okay, let me stop you.
Sure.
Okay, so your contention is that the language in the application paragraph that specifically incorporates the quote-unquote foregoing instructions and the herein before definitions, if you will, that is insufficient as a matter of law.
Yes.
To, in fact, inform.
Yes.
The jury here. Is that because there's some authority that says you can't incorporate the abstract instructions and definitions, or is it because you say that just reading the application paragraph, the jury is allowed to solely convict on the marijuana offense and not with regard to the actual shooting portion of that offense?
That's right.
So it's the latter, okay.
It's the latter, right.
That being the case, since it is permissible in your permission in your argument to incorporate, you're just saying that the incorporation was ineffective.
That's right.
Okay. Now, then, since both of the incorporation languages refer to the offense as the intentional or knowing delivery and in the course of that delivery, so there's a conjunctive use of the word and to define the offense as effectively two elements: in the course of the marijuana situation and anticipating injury to another, i.e. the shooting. Why is that insufficient to identify for purposes of the jury's consideration that the offense in question was conjunctive, because that's not disjunctive language?
Right, because it links only to an act clearly dangerous to human life, which is
the conspiracy element, is it not?
There is a conspiracy element, but
there are two forms of party arguments,
right,
here. One is the intent,
right,
and then the other is the conspiracy,
right,
and an element of the conspiracy involves the anticipation that a life-threatening thing would occur.
That's right. The jury would have to make that finding. That's an element for party liability. And by simply stating that an act clearly dangerous to human life, the co-defendant shooting Mr. Thrasher, that doesn't get it done, even if it's conjunction. That's our contention. Because you still have there's still a mens rea requirement for party liability, and it has to be, you have to, in this case, according to your question, you would have to ask the jury, is this act clearly dangerous to human life, is that something that he should have anticipated? And that was not, the jury has not made that finding. So I don't know if that answers your question.
It is an answer to my question.
Okay.
I'm trying to figure out whether it's answered what I need or not, but I'm going to come back to it.
The key is if you read the application paragraph, could a jury find the defendant guilty of just the marijuana without making any finding on party liability as to the murder? And our contention would be yes.
Well, the terms intentional or knowing clearly qualify delivery of marijuana.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So the question is whether or not the and is sufficient so that the intentional and knowing or knowing qualifies in the course of and in furtherance of the commission he did commit or attempt to commit. An act clearly dangerous to human life? Did he intentionally or knowingly intend to commit or attempt to commit an act clearly dangerous to human life?
Right. And the problem with that is that the act clearly dangerous to human life was not committed by him. That's an undisputed fact. That's never was part of the case. Blaine Brooks, who was the shooter, was the only person that fired that shot. There's no other evidence contrary to that. And both sides, I mean, that was an undisputed fact. So
in the abstract, you requested or counsel requested, defense counsel requested and obtained in the abstract an additional instruction that, quote, a person acts with the intent to promote or assist the commission of the offense when it is his conscious objective or desire to promote or assist the commission of the offense. So that is necessarily incorporated into the application here. And it's letting the jury know that they don't have to specifically find that he pulled the trigger, but that is part of the party liability if he's involved.
Right, except it's not enough to correct what the jury is told in the application paragraph. They're not told that in the application paragraph. They're not told that they have to. The fact that you refer back to the abstract doesn't tell the jury the elements that they have to find. That's our contention. It's a dysfunctional form of application paragraph.
Then how do you deal with the harm analysis in NAVA, which basically says, because the entirety of the trial, everybody knew that they were talking about, I don't know how you pronounce the word, is it Terrell or Terrale, or
I had to look it up.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but the Spanish term for shoot, which is surprisingly factually on point.
Yeah. It is surprising, the two cases.
The court of criminal appeals made it really clear that because both the prosecution and the defense, in arguing to the jury, made it really clear that that function of telling the actual shooter to shoot was the dispositive issue that they had to find in determining whether or not he had committed the crime as a party to the shooting.
Right.
So how are the facts of this case distinguishable from what the Court of Criminal Appeals held in NAVA?
Because the bulk of this case, probably more than 80%, maybe 90%, I don't know how to gauge it, deals only with marijuana distribution. We've got witnesses from Colorado. We've got search warrants to find drugs. We have testimony about drugs, about drug operation. It only deals with the marijuana distribution throughout most of it. The only evidence that comes in regarding the shooting is from accomplice testimony, which kind of ties into point number two. But that's the only evidence of Mr. Love's involvement is from accomplices. And so the jury hears 3 weeks of testimony about a big marijuana distribution deal where they get marijuana in Colorado and they bring it down to Texas. They could certainly figure that all they had to do is find that there was a conspiracy to deliver marijuana and a murder occurred during that, and that's good enough. So the response is that the evidence shows in this case, the bulk of the evidence deals with marijuana. I mean, the only testimony as to what happened at the scene was by an accomplice witness, and the other supporting evidence is by other accomplice witnesses. So, and of course that goes.
Well, you've got O'Brien who was there. And Brooks, who did the shooting,
right.
Okay, and Mr. Love actually testified and swore up and down that he did not say what he was attributed to him.
Right.
So O'Brien says he did say it. Brooks, I don't remember whether Brooks actually testified or not. I don't think he did, but then there is the testimony from the friend of Love's then wife that he came back and said two or three times that he told him to shoot.
Right. That's right.
And your contention is that the friend of the wife is an accomplice.
Right.
After the fact, because she helped clean up the marijuana, or was she a part, was there testimony that she was a part of the operation with regard to Colorado, et cetera?
I think there's enough that she could have been prosecuted. Remember, the question is to whether she could have been prosecuted for, in this case, a lesser included offense, because that would make her an accomplice, and she could have been prosecuted for the delivery of marijuana. So, yes, we contend she's an accomplice. And the court charged that she was accomplice as a matter of fact, not as a matter of law.
Okay, you've got a couple of minutes left, and I need you to explain your best argument with regard to why your client is capped at 50 years.
Okay. well, I've tried to find authority, as I told the court, I think in my reply brief, to give me some help to this court on granting of relief. Because this is so unusual with a structural error, there just isn't any. But the principle is there. The error from the original trial, the structural error, is what caused all of this to happen after that. And the state got a benefit from it. And my guy was punished because he got a greater sentence for vindicating his right to counsel. So, I mean, that's the argument. Now, one thing I would point out real quickly, because I know, is this vindictiveness that's looked at by North Carolina versus Pearson stuff. There's no, it doesn't have to prove actual vindictiveness. So our argument is that the way this all played out, got this guy an additional sentence over the 50 years, and it was through no fault of his own. It wasn't through ordinary trial error, remember. It was through structural error, and that's why I'm making this argument.
Okay.
So, thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Bryce Perry and I represent the state. I think the arguments in Mr. Love's reply brief and the arguments today have clarified what it is that he complains about with respect to the application paragraph of the jury charge. In his reply brief, he said that a rational jury misled by the judge's application paragraph instruction would simply apply the party liability law solely to the marijuana delivery. And he said something very similar to that today. But there are two big problems with respect to that argument. And the first one is as was exhibited by Justice Birdwell's question, the application paragraph included a critical conjunctive word and. And just a little bit of background about how this was charged to the jury. So, of course, this was a felony murder case that was charged as engaging in organized criminal activity with the predicate offense of felony murder. The jury was told in the abstract paragraph, that's paragraph 15 of the jury charge, about party liability principles through quoting section 7.02 of the penal code. And then in paragraph 16, that's on clerk's record page 563, the jury was told to incorporate all of that knowledge that it received in the prior paragraph into the application paragraph. And that paragraph started with, now bearing in mind the foregoing instructions, if you believe from the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant, Justin Michael Love, either acting alone or as a party thereto as herein before defined, that's the incorporation by reference, did then and there commit or attempt to commit a felony, and then it went on to talk about what that predicate felony was, the marijuana delivery, and in the course of and in furtherance of the commission, he did commit or attempt to commit an act clearly dangerous to human life, to wit, shooting a firearm at Dominic Thrasher. And the paragraph went on from there to talk about the engaging in organized criminal activity combination predicate. But that critical word and between the part of the application paragraph that discussed the predicate felony of marijuana delivery and the remaining requirements of felony murder, the act clearly dangerous to human life, and the death that occurred during that act clearly dangerous to human life, that conjunctive word and instructed the jury that it was to take that incorporation by reference at the beginning of the application paragraph and apply it to all of the requirements of that paragraph. There's no, I think there was a concession today that generally incorporation by reference of the abstract paragraphs of party liability into an application paragraph is proper. The cases cited in the state's brief, Vasquez and Chapman and Rivas all say that as well. So that and ensured that the jury would understand to apply the requirements of the paragraph to all parts of the paragraph. And nothing within the paragraph would have given them any other indication. Nothing within the paragraph would have indicated to the jury that it was to be limited as to how it would apply those application, those party liability predicates that were incorporated by reference into the application paragraph. And so in this respect, this case is not at all like Nava. Nava was a case where there was two independent application paragraphs, one that discussed the intent to promote theory of party liability, a second paragraph that discussed the conspiracy theory of party liability. And the error in that case was that in the intent to promote paragraph, the paragraph named theft as the predicate felony for felony murder, but then said to the jury that if with the intent to promote or assist the commission of the offense, that Nava solicited, encouraged, or directed the offense, he would be guilty of felony murder. And the error in that case was that the jury could have been confused about what offense that was directed toward, the underlying theft, which was the predicate felony for felony murder, or all of the other requirements for felony murder. But that's not the case here. That critical conjunctive word "and" instructed the jury to apply all of those predicates to all parts of the application paragraph.
Let me play devil's advocate then to just a moment, and that is on page 24 of your brief, you quote to paragraph 15, which is the immediate predecessor to paragraph 16, which is on page 25 of your brief, okay? And you have both the intent to promote theory quoted in paragraph 15, and you have the conspiracy theory as a separate and distinct subparagraph of paragraph 15, okay? The language of the intent to promote theory of party liability doesn't appear anywhere in the application because there's no use of the word solicit or encourage or direct or aid or attempt to aid with regard to that anywhere in the application paragraph. The to wit is immediately followed. I mean, the lead up to the to wit and immediately after the conjunction of "and" in the course and in the furtherance of the commission he did commit or attempt to commit an act clearly dangerous to human life, that more closely, by use of the word furtherance and commit, etc., more closely tracks the language with regard to the conspiracy theory. There's no since there are two potential theories pled here and argued here, there's no disjunctive between those two party liability things in the application paragraph itself. So why is that not confusing to the jury under the circumstances?
Because, Your Honor, my argument is, and I think the case law supports this very clearly, that when the jury was told about Section 7.02A2's mode of party liability, that acting with intent to promote or assist the commission of the offense, he solicits, encourages, directs, aids, all of those kinds of verbs. When the jury was told about that in the abstract paragraph, and then the jury was led in the application paragraph with bearing in mind the foregoing instructions and acting alone or as a party thereto as herein before defined, all of that language from 7.02A2 that was quoted within the abstract portion was put into through the incorporation by reference was put into the application paragraph.
The point of the application paragraph is to take the law and then instruct the jury with regard to its application as alleged by the state under the circumstances with regard to factual specificity. And so just dumping the abstract by reference, by incorporation into the application doesn't necessarily tell the jury exactly how it's supposed to apply to the specific facts alleged.
And Your Honor, with respect to that, the Vasquez case from the Court of Criminal Appeals, this is cited in the state's brief, but it's 389 Southwest 3rd, 361 at page 368. What that case says is that if the defendant is dissatisfied with an incorporation by reference and asks the court to more narrowly tailor how abstract theories of party liability should be incorporated and instructed to the jury. For instance, if the defendant believes that maybe there's evidence of aiding but not evidence of soliciting, something along those lines, he can ask for a narrowing of that language and for language to be put in more specifically. But that wasn't what happened here. What happened here in the trial court was that at the charge conference, there was an objection whole cloth to any application of party liability theories to the felony murder at all. There wasn't an objection to the manner of the submission of those party liabilities. And Vasquez says that if there's not that kind of objection, a simple statement at the beginning of the application paragraph that incorporates by reference those theories into the paragraph is sufficient. But I think all of that really can be academic. And the reason that it can be academic is because given the exclusive focus of the way the parties presented this case at trial, not just the state, but also the defense, the jury absolutely could not have been confused that all they needed to find was complicity, party liability complicity with respect to the felony murder and not the other requirements of the felony murder paragraph. The exclusive focus of the parties' dispute with respect to the intent to promote theory is whether Love had yelled, "Shoot him, Blaine." Love concedes this in his brief at pages 15 and 16 and 17, and the record repeatedly shows this. During voir dire, the state used a Fred and Barney example and told the jury that Fred could be found guilty of murder if he instructed Barney to stab a store clerk and if Barney did so. During the state's opening statement of Reporter's Record 5, page 50, the state said that it wanted the jury to watch for and listen for strong evidence of verbal solicitation at the critical moment when Blaine Brooks shot Dominic Thrasher. You'll hear that he did so when this defendant told him to do so. Later on in the state's closing argument, this might be the most particular time where the state emphasized this point, but the state said, this is volume 13, pages 28 and 31, what did he do that solicits, encouraged, aided, or attempted to aid the commission of the offense? Real easy. Shoot him, Blaine. Shoot him, Blaine. That's when he solicited, encouraged, and or directed. There's no suggestion ever by any of the parties that the jury could convict Mr. Love for felony murder based on encouraging or soliciting or directing a marijuana delivery. All of the arguments from voir dire, as the parties set it up, through the state's opening statement, through the defense opening statement, volume 5, page 58, through the defense closing argument, volume 13, pages 46 and 30 and 61, all of them told the jury that to convict Mr. Love for felony murder on that theory of party liability, the jury would have to find that he instructed Mr. Brooks to shoot Thrasher and that Mr. Brooks did so because of that instruction. There's not been any time in the opening brief, in the reply brief, or today where the appellant has analyzed the record to show that in the context of the whole record, the jury could have been misled as to that requirement. And so even, I don't think there was any ambiguity or error in the application paragraph of the jury charge, but even if there was some ambiguity with respect to that, it can't be harmless. And the Nava case is a fantastic comparison with respect to that. As the court noted in its questioning, the error in that case was ultimately held to be harmless because all of the parties' arguments in the trial of that case centered around whether Mr. Nava had yelled Tirale right before his co-conspirator had shot the police officer. And that is just a perfect factual comparison to the facts of this case. So I would posit that even if there might be some ambiguity or error under the circumstances of this case, it simply can't be harmless. I would like to go on and discuss briefly issue number two, which regards
let me ask you this, and you may be already anticipating my question, but your brief argues that the corroboration of accomplice witnesses does not have to be complete, okay? But how are we to determine what effectively you're arguing that there can be corroboration of the weather, you know, something that is important to the context of the crime, but not necessarily concerning a particular element of it. In other words, all the elements are actually provided by accomplice testimony here, okay? So he says he didn't say that. O'Brien is an accomplice, and wife and wife's friend arguably are accomplices because, in fact, they're cleaning up the marijuana and they're cleaning up the crime after the fact, okay?
type of thing. So what is there some type of materiality standard with regard to corroboration that, you know, there's a point where the corroboration is sufficient, but it's not sufficient if it's not material? It seems to be what the state's arguing is that there is material corroboration, but not necessarily with regard to the actual elements if we find that wife and friend are actually accomplices.
Yes, thank you for that question, Your Honor. The standard under Article 38.14 is whether non-accomplice evidence tends to connect the defendant to the offense. And the case law with respect to that says mere presence is not enough, but evidence of some participation in the offense is enough. And I want to cite the court to two cases. The argument in this court in briefing and today is that non-accomplice evidence was required to prove the party liability predicates, that it wasn't enough to show Mr. Love was there at the time of the shooting and that he was a part of the drug conspiracy that led to the shooting, but that the non-accomplice evidence actually had to prove the party liability predicates under 7.02A2 or 7.02B. But that's not the state of Texas case law. There's a case called Joubert versus State, 235 Southwest 3rd, 729. It's a Court of Criminal Appeals case from 2007. And in that case, the Court of Criminal Appeals said the appellant's admission that he participated in the crime, although he denied being a shooter, is enough to tend to connect him to the offense. And right before that sentence, the Court of Criminal Appeals said that the non-accomplice connection need not establish the exact nature of a defendant's involvement as a principal or as a party. There's another case called Guzman versus State. This is 07-15-341-CR. 2016 Westlaw 413-4596, and the Amarillo Court of Appeals decision from 2016. And in that case, the court, citing back to Joubert, said appellant's liability as a principal or under a party's theory is of no relevance under an Article 38.14 analysis.
Well, let me give you an example. Let's take the text message, to Thrasher before the actual meeting occurred, okay? The testimony from O'Brien is that was done under the instruction of Love. Love told me to text and say, don't mess with us, okay? And then we went, okay? Well, that would be some evidence of anticipation of possible violence. Does the text message itself, is that sufficient corroborating evidence? Okay, because that's independent. You can either you either have independent evidence that that message was sent and received by Thrasher, or you don't. Okay, is that sufficient to corroborate the testimony of the context of why it was sent? That would seem to me to be a good place where we could talk about corroboration with regard to the elements here, because just the fact that it was sent would indicate that O'Brien anticipated that there might be some violence, but it wouldn't necessarily say anything about whether Love did unless you got O'Brien's testimony that he told me to send it.
Yes, Your Honor. The Article 38.14's accomplice witness limitation applies to testimony, not to other kinds of evidence, whether physical evidence or electronic evidence like a text message. So the text message as physical evidence could be used to corroborate the non-accomplice, to corroborate the accomplice testimony. But I just want to stress, I don't think that's required here. And part of the questioning for the appellant was, could Ms. Gallagher's or Ms. Seltzer's acts after the murder, in which they're cleaning up and hiding evidence, make them accomplices? Texas law rejects that completely. The case law cited in the state's brief that says that a witness's mere attempts to cover up a crime does not make the witness an accomplice. And the argument in the reply brief for Mr. Love is that Gallagher and Seltzer are accomplices not because they participated in the murder, but because they were a part of the felony drug combination. But there's no record cite whatsoever in the reply brief or the opening brief for the idea that Gallagher or Seltzer were part of the combination of selling marijuana. And the evidence at trial did not bear that out either. Galahar testified that she had never weighed or packaged marijuana for Love. She testified she had not intended for Thrasher to be murdered. That's volume 11, 231 and 249. With respect to her overall involvement in Love's drug ring, another witness said that most of the time Galahar would be taking her children out of the way when those transactions were happening at his house. That's volume 836. Galahar testified that when she was at Love's house, she and her children would hang out in the bedrooms when he conducted that business. That's volume 11, 180. And there was similar testimony from Seltzer. There's even less of a connection from Seltzer to any part of Love's drug business. And Seltzer, of course, was important because she heard Love, when he returned to the house after the murder, say that he had...
Okay, very, very quickly, and I'll give counsel a little bit of additional time on rebuttal. Your response with regard to the cap, the 50-year cap.
Yes, Your Honor. Two basic responses to that. Number one, the fact that his conviction was reversed for structural error after the first trial has nothing to do with the question of whether he can be assessed a greater sentence on retrial. Structural error, the purpose of structural error is to say to an appellate court that no harm analysis is required to reverse conviction, which is why this court didn't engage in one when it reversed Mr. Love's conviction the first time. But there's nothing about structural error that says that it's a special kind of error that prevents a longer sentence upon retrial. There's no case that says that. There hasn't been one cited. And the second response I would have to that is, even in the circumstance where structural error could theoretically serve as a limitation to an ability to assess a longer sentence on retrial, there would have to be some showing that the structural error infected the second trial. But there's no showing at all that the structural error of the removal of Mr. Love's counsel at the first trial infected the second trial. In fact, Mr. Love's counsel from the first trial represented him at the second trial. And there's no argument in his briefing that there was anything that happened at the first trial that infected the second trial.
And there's no citation to any conduct by the trial court to indicate that there was any type of retaliation vis-a-vis any kind of rulings or anything of that nature for being reversed.
There's none, Your
okay.
Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
If you will add a minute to defense counsel's time, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. I probably won't need that whole minute, but
just in case.
Let me respond to the first issue regarding the Nava case. And the Nava case, the outcome was different, I think, because the charge was different. And I had attached, I think, as an appendix to my brief, that the charge from Nava, just to do a comparison, because they actually did have the intent to promote language and should have anticipated language in the paragraph, even though it was confusing. It could have went to the theft as opposed to the shooting.
Is counsel correct that the objection to the application paragraph at trial was that there was no evidentiary basis for a submission of a party of party liability globally, as opposed to there wasn't a specific objection that there's no language in the application paragraph about solicit or aid or anything, the specifics with regard to the two types of ways you can have party liability. In other words, as counsel has said, manner. There was no objection to the manner of its submission. It was an objection to the totality of its objection. It should never have been submitted, period.
Right. Are you asking about the...
Right. Because that determines whether we're looking at a some harm or whether we're looking at an egregious harm, is it not?
Well, yes, but I think it's egregious harm when you don't have a finding on an essential element. So,
okay,
the harm is that the finding wasn't made. The argument that they made, and through your questions using the conjunctive and, does that clean it up? In the Nava case, they didn't have to worry about that because they actually had that language incorporated in there, even though it was confusing. But anyway,
okay,
you can look at that. But I did that just to aid the court to see, because maybe that made a difference in the outcome. With regard to the text message question and other stuff, it's our contention that the corroboration has to go to Mr. Love's complicity in the murder, not just driving the car and being there and being a party in a very real sense. Even though he was present at the time and there's accomplices saying worse things about him, his position is somewhat like his wife and Ms. Seltzer's position, because all they're corroborating is that he was merely present. When you eliminate the accomplice testimony, you eliminate any complicity that he has to the actual murder itself. And I understand corroboration doesn't have to be...
Well, he corroborates that he was there.
He corroborates his presence.
He just basically denies he did anything
other
than drive.
That's right. And so...
Why does not the fact that he drove, why is that not corroborative evidence?
Because that's just being present, mere presence at the scene of a crime is insufficient.
Understand, so. But driving to a place...
Right.
Where something is about to occur, where the crime is anticipating to occur. Well, was there testimony that they were just out on a lark of some kind?
They were out there to deliver weed.
No, I understand but he was the one in control of the vehicle.
Right.
And he was the one determining where that vehicle went.
That's right.
Okay. And so was his testimony that basically he was just kind of driving around. He was the one who made the determination of when to stop, when not to stop, etc. Why is that not some type of corroborating evidence?
It's not sufficient because it doesn't corroborate the party liability, the intent to promote or assist, or the should have anticipated.
Transportation is never corroboration. Why is transportation the same as presence?
I think that's...
In other words, I understand completely why presence is not corroborating, because it's the whole notion of in the wrong place at the wrong time, okay? Mm-hmm. But if you're the one who transported yourself to the place,
right. Okay,
and the only reason you're at the place is because you put yourself there, why is that in and of itself not corroboration?
That only corroborates the marijuana sale. It doesn't corroborate that he said shoot him, and it doesn't corroborate that he anticipated a shooting would occur.
Okay.
So I understand what you're saying, but that's kind of the crux of what we're doing here is talking about that.
Okay.
I did want to say on structural error, one final thing, it's not the vindictiveness, it's that in order to assert his Sixth Amendment right to counsel, he had to go through an appeal, and he ended up worse off, and it was because of a mistake that the state and the judge made. And we're not saying that they intentionally were vindictive, but it was a mistake that they made. So I think the two are tied together. But anyway,
okay.
I thank the court very much.
All right. Thank you very much. Argument's been very helpful. We appreciate counsel's participation in it. And the case is submitted for our consideration, and y'all are excused. Thank you very much.